This podcast is brought to you by the Village of Bedford Park, your home for business. Over 450 businesses strong and growing with a safe, reliable Lake Michigan water supply. Visit VOBPbiz.com and bring your business home to the Village of Bedford Park.
This is Chicago's all-news station, News Radio 780 and 105.9 FM. Now, the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
WBBM News Time, 12:03. It is great to have you with us for the Wednesday edition of the Noon Business Hour. I'm Cisco Cotto.
And I'm Jennifer Kuiper. Coming up on today's Noon Business Hour, Tesla's meteoric Wall Street rise was short. On Personal Finance Wednesday, we will discuss financial infidelity and a guide to talking about politics while at work.
Right now, a report on employment in the private sector is out ahead of Friday's comprehensive jobs report for January. To talk about it and provide some insight, we're joined by Diane Swonk, chief economist at Grant Thornton here in Chicago. Diane, looks like private payrolls rise 291,000 in January. Talk about the significance of this.
Well, it's really hard to tell because this is not the best indicator of what the official economic data from the government comes out. And it's also, it looks like there was maybe some unseasonably warm weather that could come through in the January payroll number. What's more important about the January number that's coming out on Friday is that they're going to have the revisions to most of 2018 and early 2019, actually backward revisions in there. And it's going to be one of the biggest downward revisions that we've seen, at least according to preliminary data that we've seen since 2009. So even though it would take certainly good news if we get it, an upside surprise, I embrace it. I hope it's true. But this isn't the best indicator out there. It's been a very misleading indicator for the government payroll numbers.
Yeah, not exactly the sort of number that should cause Wall Street to take off.
No, not at all. And in fact, you know, one of the things that's really been kind of stunning with Wall Street's rally is how much they've ignored the potential earnings impact of the coronavirus on many companies. And that's something, it is still a fluid thing. And we certainly hope that we can get these, you know, treatments are going to work and that a vaccine will get done out there. But it's sort of a premature rally, you might say, because there's this, we still have a lot of uncertainty and the situation is still much of China is shut down, and that's going to impact it's in production in Korea, and will hit some middle market manufacturers here as well as the big multinational firms.
Diane, we've heard a lot about the coronavirus in recent weeks. Could we see action this year from the Fed in light of it?
You know, if it does have a demonstrative effect, there, you know, the estimates are all over the board, and we're trying to do our own, and you're sort of operating in the dark here. If it does suppress growth dramatically in the first quarter, the Fed could actually ease. I think the Fed, I've already have an easing one cut this year anyways, because the Fed is missing what it'd like in heat in terms of wages. And so that's going to be something we'll persistently see, wages around 3% growth when they come out on Friday. That's below the peak of close to 3.5% a little over a year ago in February of 2019. So there is already a propensity. The threshold for the Fed to cut rates is much lower than the threshold for the Fed to raise rates anytime soon.
And what's the latest on the U.S. service sector?
So we saw the non-manufacturing index came out and it was stronger, and that's great. It's really kind of not a service sector index. The parts that pulled it down were really in mining, in the oil industry where there's losses, and that's where the weakness was. The rest of the service sector looked like it was doing better, which is, you know, again, with the ISM number we saw for manufacturing, there really was this sense that not only did the service sector not get contagion from the recession we saw in manufacturing last year, but manufacturing might be coming out of its slump as well. Now, you know, the service sector is vulnerable too from the coronavirus because of the blow to travel and tourism. And so we'll see how that goes forward. This is kind of backward looking information, but it certainly was welcome news right now.
Always appreciate your insight. Diane Swonk, chief economist at Grant Thornton here in Chicago.
Coming up, a guide to talking about politics while at work. It's a presidential election year leading to a greater likelihood that the topic of politics will come up at work. Let's discuss some of the pitfalls and ways to avoid them with Rick Cobb, executive vice president, Challenger Gray and Christmas. And Rick, no doubt there has already been talk going on today in the office after last night's State of the Union address. There was talk yesterday about the Iowa caucus mess. But what do workers think about this kind of office talk?
Well, it's an interesting dynamic. So when you look at the office environment, most companies observe that there's discussion about politics in the office, well over 50% of them. And yet, at the same time, most workers are uncomfortable about the concept of discussion of politics in the office space. So it's an issue that tears people sort of in half in many ways, not just the political position. And at work, you have the dynamic of, does the decisions made by those in office affect your business, and in what way? And then also, how does your boss feel? What's your boss's position relative to the political landscape? So there's a lot of landmines out there in the working world for discussion of politics.
Does political discussion vary by age, and what I'm talking about, who initiates it?
We don't have hard data on that. I think generically what you've got are you have people that are much more firmly in one camp or another, and I think as a result, those more senior, and that typically is going to be the boomers, have a senior position in the organization more commonly, and therefore are more inclined to express their opinions. I think that you know, those that are older, and I qualify as that, feel like we've earned the right to talk about it, whereas I think others are more careful. Of course, on the other side of it, those first coming into the working world probably feel like they've got I won't say a naive, but a belief that everybody's entitled to their opinion and will also speak their mind. So I don't know that it breaks down by age.
And is this difficult because there could be positive or negatives here? If you're talking politics at the office, yes, there could be a lot of tension, but you could also develop some camaraderie, some connection with people who are like-minded politically.
Sure, and we have a tendency, you know, we have a natural tendency, confirmation bias psychologically, to seek out those that agree with us and look for information that supports what we already believe. That's just how humans work. The other things that we struggle with in terms of just how we function as humans is we have hardwired behaviors. One of them is defensive pride. The same thing that gets us in trouble in a road rage environment is that I'm defending myself and somehow I feel challenged, or we're seeking status. We want to feel better about ourselves, and winning or being right is one of those ways to feel better. Those things happen almost subconsciously. And you have to be really careful of that, because these are people that otherwise you work with and like. So probably the best thing to do is try to find places where you can agree. You know, yeah, you think this way, I think that way. But where are the places where we see, what do we have in common, and focus on those instead of the differences?
And is that, instead of, you talked about some people who feel like they can really throw their opinions out there, is it better to do more questions, you know, asking more about your coworkers' opinions, to try to get out what they believe and create that sense of safety when you're having these discussions?
Sure, you have to give people the room to get out of it, though. I think that's it. So civil, you want to be civil. You want to know the people that you're talking to. You're really not stumping. You're not campaigning. And if you really have to talk, it's always better to ask questions. I'm far less likely to be upset about what I'm saying than what you're saying. So if you're asking me a question, then I'm answering it. I feel okay with that answer. And I think that gives the other side a chance to understand the position, not necessarily agree with it, but understand it. But you need out clauses. You know, can I interrupt? I differ, but it's an interesting point that you're making. I'm really not comfortable talking about this right now. Can we move on? I respectfully disagree. I see you feel strongly. Give yourself ways to get out of the conversation without getting into direct conflict.
How about management? How should management handle the political talk to keep the peace and keep the work flowing?
Well, it's an interesting question. So in Illinois is one of the states where the employers, they're not allowed to discriminate against employees for election-related speech and political activities, over and above any sort of labor sorts of issues that may present themselves. So Illinois, New York, and Washington. So there's the legal component of that. I think the other part of it is, though, that you also have tremendous leverage as the senior executive and leadership, and you set the tone. So what's the company's culture? What's the status of the person who's espousing the opinion? I think the best way to do this is to encourage people to talk about work environments and non-political issues, and if it gets into a political conversation, try to broker the peace as quickly as possible and take it out. The other real big issue, though, is, and we've run into this in our own organization, I think people run into it all the time, is social media. You know, you get your blood going, somebody says something at one of the news programs you're watching, and you decide to get online and vent. That's not in a vacuum. Not only can your employer and your fellow employees see it, but any other place that you might want to work in the future is also looking at that. And if you're in business development, also your potential customers.
Good advice. Thank you, Rick Cobb, Executive Vice President in Chicago here, Challenger, Gray, and Christmas.
Up next, United Airlines takes action to ensure an influx of new pilots.
Money Talks as the WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
A podcast of the Noon Business Hour available each and every weekday at the radio.com app. United Airlines buying its own flight academy to help speed up the training of pilots. Let's learn more about the effort. Ken Goldstein is joining us, president of KJG International Consulting, based here in Chicago. Ken, is this because of a pilot shortage or an expected shortage? We've heard a little bit about that.
Well, good afternoon, Cisco and Jennifer. Thanks for having me on. Long and short is this is something we've been talking about for several years on the NBH. And the situation is you got a graying of America, you'll excuse the term, but the current crop of pilots are getting older and they need to retiring. There's a big gap there. The other thing is the airlines have been trying to find ways to increase because they got all types of routes and new planes coming in. They need someone to fly them. So what United has done is they kind of put their money where their mouth is. Rather than doing a program where we tie in with a school, they're going to buy a school. And their hope by doing this, and it's Westwood School of Aeronautics here in Phoenix, they're going to hopefully get out by 2021, up to 300 students and 500 by maybe a year or two after that. So this is a big situation on their part. Plus, by doing this, they could hopefully attract minority women and kind of make the pilot or the cockpit look more like the rest of the country rather than all white guys up there.
So they can, it sounds like, sort of be a part of really being in charge of the process here, you're saying, instead of allowing a school to do that.
Yeah, the long and short is not necessarily that they want to be in charge of the process. They want to funnel them. They need to get pilots because becoming a pilot is a very costly operation, upwards of $100,000, and you got to get the hours. So by doing this, they get them involved there, get them up to they have their flight instructor license, they can build their hours, and then funnel them initially to the regional carriers where the big need is. That's people who fly like to Peoria, to Des Moines, to local shots out of O'Hare, if you will. And by getting them there and building up the hours, they then will eventually get them up to the main cockpit or the main airline, which is, of course, United. So, and that's where they're looking at, if you will, better pay. They start about $80,000, could go even higher.
But it sounds like that this cost quite a bit to go undergo this training. I think the number I saw was $80,000. So how does United plan to attract a more diverse pool?
Well, by coming in with financial incentives, giving them loans, et cetera, as do programs right now with JetBlue and American, by attracting the people and hopefully even coming out of high school and saying, look, you come from a diverse background. Here's a way to help you get into the program. It may take a bit, but we'll get you there. In the past, the situation is people have gone into the military, and that's where most of the pilots have come initially to the airlines. But that could be anywhere from 5 to 6 years that the military wants a commitment. And the military, candidly, has a problem, too, of retention. And more importantly, they need to start acquiring people to get in and become pilots.
That's Ken Goldstein. Thanks so much for all the insight. Ken is president of KJG International Consulting. Still ahead, Personal Finance Wednesday. Are you committing financial infidelity? Good afternoon. Great to have you with us. I'm Cisco Cotto.
And I'm Jennifer Kuiper. These are the top stories on News Radio WBBM.
Top American automakers are reporting their fourth quarter results.
In Personal Finance Wednesday, more than 4 in 10 Americans admit to hiding a bank account or extra spending from a partner. We'll discuss financial infidelity.
The fates of at least a dozen Catholic parishes in the Chicago area will be revealed this week.
The GOP-controlled Senate appears virtually certain to acquit President Trump on 2 impeachment charges today.
Wall Street, the Dow up 355 points. NASDAQ is up 19. The S&P up 27. And oil today is up a little less than 4%.
And AccuWeather says a winter weather weather advisory goes into effect at 3 this afternoon until 9 a.m. tomorrow for Northwest Indiana and until noon tomorrow for areas well south of Chicago.
The Noon Business Hour is presented by Republic Bank of Chicago.
Markets are higher today. We're joined by Jim Awad, Senior Managing Director of Clearstead Advisors, LLC. And Jim, what is your take on the markets today?
Well, you got some good economic news in terms of both the employment report and the ISM services index. Also, some feeling that maybe this virus is not going to be as bad as was feared last Friday. And then finally, you know, the stock market is all about money, and the economy is doing well, and Trump's approval rating, the latest poll on the economy and in general, is up. And personal feelings aside, the market is rooting, collectively is rooting for Trump, because all the other candidates on the other side are going to raise taxes significantly. So those are the factors propelling the market today.
One of the things I want to point out, because we were talking about it yesterday, what's going on with Tesla? It was first it was up 19%, then yesterday it was up 20 or 21%,
right.
And now it's taken the plunge. So what's going on here?
Yeah, well, you know, go figure. I've been doing this for 51 years, and every once in a while something comes along that is very hard to analyze clinically, and this is one of them. Look, I understand the bull case for Tesla long-term, the opportunity. I also understand the shorts who feel that valuation has become a real issue. So I would say that the spike in the stock up and the collapse today are frightening, unanalyzable, and I would advise people to do nothing in Tesla and let the stock settle out and the bulls and the bears fight each other.
Yeah, you have to have, I don't know, a lot of patience, a lot of strength, really strong stomach if you're going to get into a stock like that.
Yeah, well, you know, you've also got to have a very long-term view and only have your most at-risk assets in it. If they pull it off, I mean, you had this fellow Ron Barron on last week saying he thinks it could be a several $1,000 stock, and he's successful and wealthy, and you know, you got some real believers, and then you have people who say there's no way to justify this valuation.
So let's talk about Disney. What was in Disney's call? They beat expectations, and yet the stock is down 3.5% today.
Yeah, well, look, it was a good quarter, both in terms of revenues and earnings, and it's a great long-term story. You're getting a little bit of a negative response today because of they're going to have to close their parks in China for a period of time, and also they've got some heavy development spending coming up. But this is a company very successfully transitioning to the new streaming business model. They've got the content and the distribution, and I would basically ignore the modest decline in the stock today.
How did Disney initially get subscribers, and is there any concern that some of the subscribers will leave when whatever deal they agree to ends?
Yeah, well, this is a new industry, and there's a school of thought that says that people are going to go from one streaming service to another based on short-term content. So we don't know the overall profitability of the model yet, but we do know that the old cable model is dying, and you have to be in the streaming model and be in it as strongly as you can and get as many viewers as you can, and then we'll see how the profits work out. But you have no choice but to go ahead and be as aggressive as you can to get subscribers.
And the company did not update any Disney Plus guidance, correct?
Right. You know, they had a very good number, and some, I should have added that. Some people were disappointed that they didn't up their guidance based on that. But I think they're leaving themselves some wiggle room rather than up the guidance and disappoint. You know, they do have the investment spending. They do have the China issue. And so, you know, it was probably prudent just to leave the guidance where it was.
And Jim, where do they fall within all of the streaming services that we're seeing compared to Netflix or Hulu?
Yeah, I think there's room for everybody. You know, pricing is going to be an issue, and the feeling a few months ago was that Netflix is going to have to come down to meet all the new competition. But people are starting to talk about the fact that people like Disney and NBC and you know, all these different services probably have room to up their prices once they get their subscribers. So I would say there's probably room for everybody, but it's going to take a few years to create a pecking order. It's sort of like the Democratic Iowa caucus. You know, it's very crowded, and it's going to take a while to sort things out.
What do you make of the Casper IPO? Some calling it a disaster. The Casper is a mattress in a box company, and
yeah,
Seems like they keep lowering the share price.
Yeah, you could see this coming. I mean, it's a very competitive market. The market has become, the stock market has become very skeptical about companies with high revenue growth and no earnings and not generating cash. And so you could see this coming. I think Casper was being much too optimistic in trying to portray themselves as a technology company when really, as you said, they just sell a mattress in a box and there's a lot of competition out there. So it's not a new issue I would be interested in.
How does Wall Street deal with this in regard to the coronavirus? You have obviously a lot of companies that may get hurt, economies that may get hurt, but it may spur a Fed rate cut sometime this year. So that makes it kind of a mixed bag economically and for the markets.
Yeah, well, I think the markets are looking at the glass as half full now. They're saying that while the virus is still spreading, at the moment at least, it does not seem like it's going to have a huge economic impact outside of China. That the Chinese are adding tremendous stimulus. That interest rates around the world have come down, which is a stimulus. That although world growth will be slowed down somewhat by this virus, particularly in Asia, but a lot of it will be regrouped in terms of pent-up demand on the other side. For instance, they're saying that Apple will be unable to ship 1 million iPhones because of the shutdown of the factories. Well, those iPhones will be sold in the second or third quarter when this passes. So there's a risk. There's a risk. I mean, the markets are being very optimistic. There's a risk that this thing gets out of control. But my experience is that you can usually normalize through black swans. There will be a cure for this. There'll be some damage between now and then. But at the end of 2020, I don't think it's going to be the item that we're talking about as the most dominant factor in driving equity prices for the year. I think the economy and the election will be more important.
Jim Awad, thank you so much. Jim is Senior Managing Director at Clearstead Advisors, LLC.
Your daily transaction for useful information. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
It's Personal Finance Wednesday on the Noon Business Hour. Not all couples are totally transparent about money and spending. Let's discuss financial infidelity just ahead of Valentine's Day. Ted Rossman, industry analyst at creditcards.com, based in New York. Ted, financial infidelity, what sorts of secrets are we talking about here?
Three main categories: spending money that your spouse or partner wouldn't be comfortable with, keeping a secret account, that could be a credit card, a checking account, a savings account, or carrying secret debt. And all told, 44% of people who are married or otherwise living with a partner are keeping one of these secrets. It's highest among millennials at 57%.
And so which of those, I guess they're all potentially dangerous, right, if you keep those things hidden?
They are. The most common is spending money without your partner's consent. Men are actually the most guilty of that, which I think would surprise a lot of people. Again, millennials stand out doing this at a much higher level than other generations. I think some of it for millennials is that they grew up with divorced parents in many cases, you know, more likely than older adults. So they like their financial freedom. They're worried about if the relationship doesn't last, so they keep their own habits. And, you know, the same thing goes for people getting married later on. Old habits die hard, but we need to communicate about these things. You can't go it on your own if you're in a relationship with somebody.
What do those questions say about financial infidelity? What do they think about it?
27% actually think that it's even worse than physical cheating. So this is a big deal for a lot of people. What we have found is that people are very forgiving when they know about it. It may be uncomfortable at first, but you can get past, you know, the fact that somebody may have student debt, let's say, from their past that you didn't initially know about, but you got to come clean about it. You know, spending, I know sometimes it's hard to come home after you've spent a little too much at the mall, but you've got to be honest about these things. The other person's probably going to find out, and the breach of trust is even worse than the act in the first place.
And you mentioned that one of the things was old habits. So sometimes this happens because it's just a habit and it just carries over. It could be an affair. It could be, what else could it be? Would it just be hiding stuff? Is it something that we don't know about here?
It's usually that people want privacy and they want to control their own finances. Sometimes it's something more nefarious, like physical cheating or addiction or something like that. But for the most part, it's people are uncomfortable talking about money. They want to do their own thing. A lot of people say, well, you know, we both work, right? There's more two-income households nowadays than ever. So I work hard. I should get to control my own money. That works if you agree on the parameters ahead of time. You can't just do it on your own. But if you say, like, all right, so me and my spouse, we're each going to get a certain portion of every paycheck. That can be ours, no questions asked. That separation works for a lot of people, but you have to agree on the parameters. You can't just have somebody spending willy-nilly without the other person's knowledge.
So parameters, you're talking how much, right? So each of you gets X number of dollars, and you, okay, this money you can spend however you want. I don't care. I don't want to know about it. But you can't just be raiding the bank account, you know, sort of off and on throughout the pay period.
Exactly. I hear more and more couples really benefiting from this yours, mine, and ours approach, where there's some pot of money that's commingled for household expenses, and then each person gets some money to do as they wish. You've got to communicate, though. Maybe set a monthly or even quarterly money date. You know, make it low pressure. Just touch base on where you are with your income, your expenses, your goals. We need to bring this more in the open. People are more likely to talk about politics, religion, their weight. They don't want to talk about their money, and we need to change that.
Ted Rossman, thanks for joining us. Ted is an industry analyst at creditcards.com, joining us on Personal Finance Wednesday.
Making sense of your dollars. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
GM and Ford have released earnings reports, while Tesla also is in the news today. We welcome Garrett Nelson, senior equity analyst at CFRA Research. Garrett, tell us about GM and Ford's earnings.
Sure. So thanks for having me. The key really with these two releases was their 2020 earnings guidance. And for both companies, the guidance they put out there was slightly below the consensus forecast. Ford's guidance was much weaker than consensus, whereas GM's guidance was only slightly weaker. So, you know, we think that really reflects ongoing headwinds that the U.S. automakers are facing, both domestically and abroad. U.S. auto sales continue to decline, and globally, auto sales were down about 4% this year, and we're expecting another 3% decline this year.
Sounds like GM is feeling a little more confident. They've got that strike behind them. And are you surprised about the hit that they did take from the strike, or the little hit that they took and not maybe as big as some might have thought? The CFO this morning was saying that she thought that they were going to have a very good 2020 and that they had that kind of stuff out of the way.
So the fourth quarter, I think most analysts weren't focused on as much because everyone realized they had the 40-day strike, 25 days of which impacted the fourth quarter. So, you know, they managed to eke out a small adjusted earnings profit for the quarter. The quarter was slightly ahead of consensus. So that was positive. And I think that's why the stock is kind of holding its ground today, whereas Ford is trading significantly lower.
What are your thoughts on Tesla here? As we've had, man, quite a roller coaster, way up yesterday, way down today. I mean, it's sort of difficult, especially for investors.
Sure. So it's been a parabolic run-up in the stock recently, and it's coming back to earth today. The stock is down almost 20% right now. And, you know, there was some news out this morning. They have delayed vehicle deliveries from their brand-new factory that just started up in China due to the coronavirus, which is one of the things we had feared. We currently have a sell rating on the stock. But on the conference call last week, they said that the factory would be shut down for a week to a week and a half. And it now looks like that could certainly go on a lot longer than that, which will really weigh on their first quarter results, we think.
And Garrett, I just want to ask you this because you really look at the whole industry just in general terms. What about this year and average transaction prices and incentive spending? So I'm looking from the consumer end. Are we going to see any deals out there, or no? Are they holding that money close to the vest?
So average vehicle selling prices have never been higher, and that's what's really weighing on overall vehicle sales for the new vehicle market, and it's really driving more sales in the used market. Actually, if you look at the spread, the difference in average monthly payments for a new vehicle versus a used vehicle, the difference has never been higher. So, you know, we view that as a positive for used vehicle retailers, companies such as CarMax is one of our top picks, and in a headwind that will continue to weigh on the major U.S. automakers.
Thanks so much. Good insight, Garrett Nelson, Senior Equity Analyst at CFRA Research.
You'll find past programs and later today a podcast of this hour at WBBMNewsRadio.com and the Radio.com app.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.